Hey folks, we messed up. NPR made a change to our web servers that we didn't expect to have any effect on podcasts. Clearly, we were wrong. As a result, you may have received downloads you didn't ask for and had trouble finding your favorite shows. We're truly sorry. We have fixed the root cause of the problem. If you unsubscribed from this show or any other NPR show, please take a minute to resubscribe. If you're still having problems, please go to npr.org/help. We are taking steps to make sure nothing like this happens ever again. Thanks for listening, and now on to the show.
This is Only a Game. I'm J.A. Adande.
At guard in his eighth season for Michigan State, number 32, Irvin Magic Johnson.
Since the 1980s, he has called out the names of some of the greatest players in basketball history.
Kobe Bryant.
The only name you will not hear him introduce in dramatic fashion is his own.
That's a little bit too self-indulging. I'm not worthy of... That kind of acumen. I'm just really cognizant that I'm surrounded by superb, talented athletes and just happy to have that opportunity to be in their presence.
Since he won't do it, allow me to do it for him. From the University of Dubuque, in his 37th year as the public address announcer for the Los Angeles Lakers, Lawrence Tanner. For the entire 20 years, the Lakers have played at Staples Center, and for 16 of their final 17 years at the Forum before that, Tanner's smooth baritone has provided the vocal soundtrack to their games. In return, the job has provided him with the best seat in basketball, at the scorer's table, on the floor, right at half court. He's not quite close enough to touch the players, but he can talk to them.
I remember one night Michael Jordan in a preseason game was just destroying the Lakers, lighting the team up, and he came back into the game in the fourth period, and I normally don't do this, but I told Michael, he was in front of me in the scorer's bench about to check, and I said, Mike, lighten up a little bit, man. And he looked at me, have you ever had the devil look at you and say, like, how dare you ask me to lighten up? That's not a part of my motif. I don't lighten up. And I didn't say anything after that. I said, excuse me, Mr. Jordan, I apologize.
Tanner's first brush with basketball greatness came in his hometown of Chicago in the 1950s, when his father took him to see the Harlem Globetrotters, featuring Wilt Chamberlain.
That was an indelible memory, seeing a man of that stature and that tall.
And that was when Tanner fell in love with the game. He soon started playing it himself.
On the courts with chain nets, playing against some incredible men. I remember after school, we would play against the guys coming from the factory. And you had to play tough, you know. So when I played high school basketball, it was nothing compared to playing against men coming from the factories.
Tanner accepted a basketball scholarship to the University of Dubuque in Iowa. And that's when he first found himself behind a microphone at the school radio station.
Looked at the campus newspaper one day and they were looking for announcers. I had already had an affinity towards music growing up in a musical family. My uncle played with Charlie Parker. My sister used to sing with the Floyd Campbell Orchestra, so there's been this musical connection in my family over the years. And I got the audition at the campus radio station.
After college, Tanner moved to Los Angeles in the early 1970s and started working at jazz radio stations. A few years later, when the Lakers acquired a fellow jazz aficionado who happened to be pretty good at basketball, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Tanner started going to their games at the Forum.
And listening to the public address announcer, who at that time was John Ramsey. And I said, wow, that's an interesting gig. I think I could do that. I said, maybe I should apply to be a backup. Everybody needs a backup.
Tanner was friends with a player on the Lakers, Jamal Wilkes, who put him in touch with the Lakers publicist. Tanner submitted his audition tape and resume. He didn't become the next Lakers PA announcer. That was a man named Larry McKay. But when McKay's job at a local radio station changed his shift to nights, that meant he could no longer work the games. Tanner got the call and a job offer from the Lakers in 1982. He was brand new, but he benefited from the guidance of Chick Hearn, the legendary play-by-play voice of the Lakers since they arrived in Los Angeles in the 1960s.
Magic down the middle, gives underneath to Worthy, slammed up.
See, there's no public address announcer school. It's on-the-job training. So Chick Bean, you know, the legend that he was and had traveled around the country for, you know, 30 years prior to that, gave me some insight on how to approach the job. He said, first of all, try to be informative, try to be precise, and try to envision talking to somebody in the audience that's blind so they can feel what's going on verbally.
Tanner has been on the job ever since, with the exception of 1 year in the 1990s when he ran a radio station in Sacramento. He's added his own personal touches over the years.
Traveling to you, if you see a travel, what do you say?
Too many steps.
And why? I don't know. Why is that your way?
That's an interesting question. I never thought about it. It just happened. Just came about. Too many steps, which is pretty short, concise, and to the point.
If you listen to how Tanner says each player's name, you get a sense of how he views them, from the grace of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to the power of LeBron James.
Kareem is my favorite all-time player. I think he's the greatest. And to roll off his name, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, that sounds kind of majestic when you think about it.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
How do you correlate a name with a sound?
I think that's like in music, improvisation. A lot of it depends on the activity of the event on the court. I remember this last summer, people asked me, how am I going to introduce LeBron James? You know, well, I've already given him flavor just because of his acumen as a basketball savant over the years. So I wasn't sure, you know, and I practiced it a little bit. You know, I gave it some thought. And I hope it comes out the way it should.
So what does it sound like when LeBron scores a basket? Coming out of your mouth. You can give us a LeBron score.
LeBron James!
So there's kind of a growl to your voice when you say it.
Kind of, sort of, yeah.
James Worthy was a smoother style, I guess.
He was what Sade called a smooth operator.
So what did that sound like when you said
Worthy?
If you get that opening, you got to take it.
Tanner won't hesitate to acknowledge greatness from the visiting teams as well. You'll hear a begrudging bit of respect when an opposing player gets hot. One of his favorite current players is Damian Lillard of the Portland Trail Blazers, whose greatness mandates what Tanner calls a little flavor.
And little flavor means just a little bit of pepper, a little oregano, nothing heavy. No hot sauce. Damian Lillard.
Oh, look at Lillard spinning and scoring.
Not every name rolls off the tongue that easily. There are now more than 100 international players from 42 countries playing in the NBA. There are dangerous collections of consonants lurking on every roster. And while the league puts out a pronunciation guide to help,
I also go to the visiting broadcasters. How do you say this person's name? How do you say Giannis Antetokounmpo? How do you say Bismack Biyombo? How do you say Nicholas Skidishvili? I mean, every year, man, this thing just gets more and more like I'm in a linguistics class, becoming a foreign exchange student, pronouncing all these names, man. It's just unbelievable. Not too many Lou Hudsons anymore.
The makeup of the league keeps changing, but the PA voice of the Lakers remains the same. That gives it extra weight. It meant something to LeBron James that the same person who called the past four decades of Laker greats would say his own name.
It's dope. It's incredible. That's why I put him in my Nike spot in the beginning. You know, just to hear him, you know, say from St. Vincent, St. Mary, number 23, LeBron James, and that historical voice.
From St. Vincent, St. Mary's High School, LeBron James.
And while the NBA has moved toward louder, more attention-grabbing PA announcers, Tanner's low-key style makes him a throwback, a classic even. Tanner has been on the mic for 8 Lakers championships.
At this time, direct your attention to center court for the presentation of the Larry O'Brien Trophy.
And yet you won't find him flashing any of his championship rings. They're tucked inside a safe deposit box.
I would never wear one of those rings. A little bit too ostentatious for me, not my style.
He won't add to the ring collection this year as the Lakers failed to make the playoffs. There's a chance Tanner won't be on the microphone for the next Lakers championship. He says he evaluates his job year by year. One day will be his last day, and Laker games won't sound the same. 38 world records were set at Sunday's London Marathon, and that's where we're going to start this week on Three Stories You Should Know. I'm joined by WBUR's Shira Springer and by 538's Chris Herring. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Hey, Jay. How are you?
Good. Shira, that's the starting gun.
All right. Well, if you're like me, you were probably surprised to hear that 38 world records were set at the London Marathon. You're like, what? What happened? Turns out that those world records weren't set by elite runners. They came mostly from the field of runners in costume. Some examples: the world record for the fastest female in a full-body animal costume. She was dressed as a panda, and she finished in 3 hours, 48 minutes, and 32 seconds. There was also the fastest male dressed as a zombie, the fastest female dressed as a fairy tale character, Snow White, the fastest male dressed as a shoe, the fastest male as a Christmas tree, and in a separate category and also a separate person, the fastest male dressed as just a tree. And it's worth noting also that in the non-costume category, there was a world record for a couple handcuffed together. Most of the world record setters finished under 4 hours, and a few even finished under 3 hours, which is just an incredible marathon time in costume or out of costume. So, you know what? These runners in costumes deserve to call themselves world record holders. What do you think? Are you guys rolling your eyes at this or converted?
I mean, I think I'm at a point now with the stuff that's going on in the world. You have a lot of get off my lawn type sports fans. I'm 32. I don't have a lawn. I don't even own my own home yet. So I try really hard not to fall in that category. And as much as I kind of wanted to with this, I can't get angry at the idea of people having fun. I'm also someone that has never run a marathon before, and so I don't really feel like I get the right to shake my finger at someone for doing something that keeps you physically fit for 3 or 4 hours.
Well, I'm just saying I'm in awe of the additional physical burden that they take on when
yes.
wearing those costumes, and I have so many questions. Do they train with the costumes on? Is there any greater test of a couple than to run a marathon handcuffed
yeah.
together? If you saw that one guy that was wearing a Big Ben clock tower costume and it was too tall to get under the finish line stand
yeah.
and he had to make several attempts and duck under and he had to get help and that cost him about 10 or 15 seconds. He might have set a world record if not for that giant
if not for
costume.
The height of the costume. Yeah. No, I do know some costume runners and many of them do train at least part of the time in the costume just to make
wow.
sure it's manageable. As fun as it is, they're also doing it to draw attention to meaningful causes. For example, the woman who ran in the panda costume, she was raising money for the World Wildlife Fund. So it's kind of a neat way to both set a world record and draw attention to a worthy cause.
Chris, I understand you've embarked on a very important journalistic investigation.
Very important. So I've developed this kind of oddball reputation at ESPN and at 538. Where I just really like these weird, bizarre stories. I spent last year, just before the finals, writing about how Kevin Durant's shoes fell off constantly. So now all of that has led. Someone literally text messaged me a couple weeks ago and said, have you ever thought about doing a story on why Joel Embiid falls down as much as he does? I was watching the game as it happened. He had just tumbled to the court like 3 times in a row. And I said, I actually hadn't, but I don't know why I hadn't. And so that's what I've been doing for the better part of the last month. Went back and counted every single possession of the 76ers season and every single time that Joel Embiid fell down on the court. And I think it's not just the numbers behind it, which are funny, that he falls down literally every 10 minutes on the court. But strangely enough, he's actually falling down on purpose. And the reason he's doing it is because he feels like it actually helps prevent injury.
Shira, can you relate to this? Are you a faller?
Can I relate to being 7'2" and falling down?
We all fall down, right?
I joke, but in a way, yes, because as somebody who has played soccer and done gymnastics and done some very, very, very amateur ski racing, I know it's very important to know how to fall properly. But I'm curious, do you guys actually believe him? Because I know you had some other theories in the story, Chris. Like one of them was that he simply isn't a particularly graceful athlete.
I mean, you watch enough of his games. And, I don't think he's James Harden level as far as flopping or anything like that. But Joel Embiid is up there, too. I mean, he's someone that definitely likes to get under opposing player skin. And in one game against Detroit, he actually got one of their star players, Andre Drummond, ejected Andre Drummond had barely touched Joel Embiid, and Joel Embiid made it look like he'd been shot. Other players in the league will dislike you very quickly for stuff like that, but Joel Embiid loves it. He feels like anything that gives his team an advantage, anything that gets him free throws and gets his team points, he's willing to do it.
I thought it was interesting that he hadn't played basketball until he was 15 years old.
Right.
Now, was he a soccer player?
That's where you learn a good flop.
Yeah, but you're supposed to learn good balance and footwork, right? That's
right.
What they used to say. Hakeem Olajuwon was so graceful on his feet because he played soccer, but it's like Joel Embiid ignored those elements and just picked up the worst aspects of soccer and learned how to go to the ground repeatedly as they do every World Cup, it seems like.
That's what's so funny about it, too, is that all the Hakeem Olajuwon comparisons are interesting, and I think they're relevant because he is a really skilled big man, but Hakeem Olajuwon had much better balance. Mm.
And finally, this week we learned that ESPN the magazine is going away. After 21 years, its last issue will be printed in September. And ESPN the magazine might not have had the most creative name, but it had bold covers, most notably the one featuring New Orleans Saints draft pick Ricky Williams in a wedding dress next to Mike Ditka, and it had a tremendous collection of writers. Combine this with the reduced output of Sports Illustrated and that publication's uncertain future, and it feels like we're seeing the beginning of the end of sports magazines. So what will sports fans be missing?
That's a good question. It's going to be interesting to see how this evolves. I think they're obviously going to miss a platform where you could depend on great writers, not only great writers, but great writers being given the time and the resources, both financially and editorially, to really do these deep dive stories and to get into the nitty gritty and to maybe do some unusual, unconventional pieces as well. But I'm not so worried in terms of great stories coming out. I think great stories and great storytellers always find a way. I think it's just going to be a shift in where we look, but it always hurts when you have a platform taken away and such a well-supported platform that was willing to do daring things like put Ricky Williams in a wedding dress.
Chris, how did magazines influence your entry into this field?
I only remember getting maybe one or two at home, but every time I got one, you'd stop and you'd flip through it. And I think, you know, your question to Shira, that's what I think we're going to miss, because there's almost more good writing out there than there's ever been before if you're willing to find it. But how do kids get introduced to really fantastic sports writing if they don't ever see a magazine?
I remember growing up in a household where when the Sports Illustrated magazine came in the mail, everyone in the house would fight over who got to read it first.
Wow.
I mean, you know.
That was the benefit of being an only child. It was coming straight to me in my name.
See, you're lucky. Sure,
I remember that feeling of waiting, right? We also won't see that element of preservation, the permanence.
Right.
And one thing magazines did was it, you know, when it started, it was a way to give ESPN portability. So in the late 1990s, you still didn't have Wi-Fi, you still didn't have smartphones. So this was a way for ESPN to be everywhere. And I'll miss seeing NFL draft picks in a wedding dress. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been WBUR's Shira Springer, who also writes for the Boston Globe and the Sports Business Journal, and 538's Chris Herring. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jay.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Honest Beef, providing exceptional dry-aged beef via the most transparent and direct supply chain possible. They're family ranchers who believe in their customers' right to know where their food comes from. Come for their family's six-generation story and stay for the quality of their beef. Try their single-animal dry-aged ground beef or their 20-ounce dry-aged ribeyes shipped right to your door. They'd like to be your ranchers. HonestBeef.com.
We know sometimes you need a break from all of the negativity, but there are so many good things all around us. Kind World is a show about profound acts of kindness that help transform lives. New episodes every Tuesday. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jay Adande. Nick Silver lives in St. Louis. He's 34 years old, a small business owner with six kids. When he was young, he started losing his eyesight. He wasn't allowed to play contact sports like soccer and basketball. Adults told him it was just too dangerous. Nick got teased a lot.
In today's world, it's considered bullying. I didn't consider it bullying then. I wasn't put into a trash can. I wasn't stuffed in a locker. It was just it's the lack of understanding, you know.
The one thing Nick could always do was run, and he was pretty good at it.
You always want to be somebody or something or have something that you can, you know, hang your hat on.
But until last year, Nick wasn't sure he'd be able to keep running. Here's reporter Shayla Farzan in St. Louis.
When Nick Silver was born in 1985, he seemed completely healthy. Then when he was about 4 years old, he started having trouble seeing. Nick had something called juvenile onset cataracts. His doctors removed them. But then Nick developed a form of glaucoma.
Spent a considerable amount of time in the hospital during kindergarten and first grade. And really, when I came back to school, you know, I wore glasses. And, you know, I was the kid that had Coke bottles, and glasses kept getting thicker as I got older.
The kids in Nick's class called him Steve Urkel and Four Eyes. And he says sometimes he'd take off his glasses to try to blend in. The problem was he couldn't really see without them. His doctors said he could have a corneal transplant when he got older, an operation that would fix his eyesight.
Enough to where I could drive. I even had a car sitting in my backyard that was mine once I learned how to drive. 1995, red, neon. I would go to the back room and look out the window and see it sitting there, and I knew I had a couple of years before I could start learning to drive, and, you know, that magical moment would come and I would get my new eyes and I would be able to see.
Then when Nick was in fourth grade, his doctors gave him some bad news. He had too much scar tissue on his eyes to be able to do the corneal transplant. There wasn't going to be a magic surgery, and he wasn't going to be able to drive that red car in the backyard. He says he was in denial until he was about 15, when local TV news did a segment on the Missouri School for the Blind.
I knew it was coming on. They kind of teased it that morning and came from school and ran to TV. I might even set an alarm, sat down, and the weather came on. I'm like, come on, come on. I'm like, come on. And so we finally came on, and I just, like, starstruck.
The way Nick remembers it, the story was pretty simple. Just a couple kids walking around the school, talking about what it was like. But it made a big impression on him.
And I was like, I need to go there. I want to go there now. And this was a complete flip of the coin, because before then I was like, I don't want to go to that school. That school's going to make me walk with a cane. It's going to make me walk around with a dog. And I got to learn Braille.
Nick got his dad to sign the paperwork and transferred to the School for the Blind.
I was a rock star. That's what I was. I was a new kid. Everyone was like, hey, there goes that new kid. You know, who's that? Or, you know, is he from St. Louis? Because the school only had about 330 kids in it. So everybody knew everybody.
But the best thing was being able to play sports for the first time, really. The school's gym teacher and coach was named John Schrock.
Schrock, as we called him. He just, you know, he was quirky, and he was just a real down-to-earth, and he's really cool. He drove a motorcycle, and he competed in Senior Olympics. You know, even during our track season, you would see him out there after school, and it was funny because he would go and practice javelin, but he wouldn't use a javelin. He would use old white canes.
Nick says Schrock didn't think being blind meant you had to sit out. So Nick joined the track team and the wrestling team and the swim team.
I was able to do it. You know, I was able, there wasn't anyone saying, you know, be careful. There wasn't anyone screaming for their life. When you're out there and the people around you are so scared for your safety, you know, it kind of weighs you down. You run a little slower because you don't want to injure yourself and make them have a heart attack.
Nick's support network, his teammates, the sheer joy of competing, all that helped build him up and got him through some really tough years. He was living with his dad, and he says he got into the habit of waking up every day around 3 or 4 a.m.
That's the time that my dad would walk around my house, and if he was going to go crazy or flip his lid, that's when it's going to happen, and I wanted to make sure that I was coherent enough to defend myself.
This meant that when Nick graduated in 2005, he didn't have anywhere to go. A school employee broke the rules and gave him a master key that unlocked the dorms. He found an empty room. It was comfortable. It had a bed and a TV, and he could walk to the grocery store. Nick stayed there about 3 months, until one day he had to leave in a hurry.
I knew I got caught. The janitor came up there, and she's like, I'm reporting you. Everything I could grab, I grabbed it all, put it into my suitcase, and I took off as fast as I could down the street.
But he snuck back in. for a couple weeks, he slept in one of the big bins in the high school gym, the ones that hold the basketballs and the wrestling mats. As if being homeless wasn't enough, Nick's sight was getting worse and worse. At one point, he says he thought seriously about taking his own life, but a friend in Arizona convinced him to come and live with her. And once there, Nick started running again.
Sports, even in Arizona, still was a refuge, still a way for me to get out and run the dirt roads and get blasted by sand and dirt.
Nick tried to qualify for the Paralympics in 2008, but he got injured and he didn't make it.
That got me real down.
He moved back to St. Louis and took a break from sports for a while. After a couple years, he thought about getting back into running, but by this time his sight had deteriorated to the point that it wasn't really safe for him to run alone. Years earlier, Nick had been looking for a running guide in St. Louis. He posted on a website called United in Stride, but there weren't many registered runners in his area, and Nick never actually connected with any guides. Until last year, when another athlete stumbled across Nick's old online profile.
I'm Pierre Polite, and I live in Kirkwood, a suburb of St. Louis, with my family. So late night, I stumbled on a website called United in Stride, and I saw a profile of Quicksilver.
Quicksilver, that's the handle that Nick uses online. The pace Nick had listed was a little fast for Pierre's taste, a 6-minute, 30-second mile. But Pierre thought, why not? So he sent him a message.
I think it was the next morning that he reached out and said, yes, I'd be interested in running. When can you go? And my first reaction is, wow, this is happening quickly, but I work from home, so I said I can go just about any time.
Pierre had never guided a blind runner before, and he says he felt pretty nervous.
There's no guide on how to guide, and you don't know what you're supposed to be doing.
But he did find one helpful piece of advice.
It said, don't tell them what they can't do. So with that in mind, we got together, and I asked Nick, you know, what is it you want me to point out? What do you not want me to point out? And he said, just describe what you see, which sounds really, really simple. It's not. Describing how sharp a turn is or an S-turn or if there's tree branches at a certain height creeping into the trail is actually surprisingly difficult.
One of the first times they went running together, Nick told Pierre that the most important thing for him to remember was that he wasn't responsible for any accidents.
And he emphasized that if ever I run into anything, he said, it's not my guide's fault. I'm taking this risk. You do your best to describe and just take me to the hospital and drop me off was, I think, his approach to it.
They went for a couple runs with no accidents. So Pierre says they decided to up the ante a little.
It was probably our second or third meeting when we met up to go biking. And I put a bunch of zip ties into my spokes, like the baseball card that we all had as kids, poking into our spokes to make a whole bunch of noise. You get up as you speed up and slow down, which is important because he can hear how fast I'm going. And I remember one time he pulled up alongside me on the levee trail and I said, we're wide open. And he took off and he was way ahead of me. And I'm relatively fast, I think, but I was pumping hard to catch up to him. And I finally catch up to him and I'm alongside him and I'm like, wow, what got into you? I could barely catch you. And he said, oh, I thought you were in front of me. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna kill this guy and be completely responsible for that happening.
I'm sure I scare him. I scare the bejesus out of him, but he doesn't stop me. He doesn't say I can't do it. He won't tell me I can't.
Nick and Pierre have been running and biking together for about a year. And Pierre says, just like with any other relationship, they've gotten more comfortable with each other.
Nick has a sense of humor that comes through and makes things a whole lot easier. So very quickly, you go from being a guide to being a friend. And where that line is, I don't know anymore.
When Nick's sewer backed up, Pierre came over to help. And that's not the only time he stopped by.
He got 3 puppies, which I still think he's crazy for having. He needed the back fence shored up or repaired, and so I helped him with that.
He's become almost like a father figure. I turn to him like I would a parent sometimes.
Nick ran his first half marathon in Houston in January. Right now, Pierre and several other guides are helping him train for at least 8 more races this year.
I don't know what I can do to show my appreciation, but in a lot of ways, the only way I think I can show my appreciation is by doing my very best at each and every race I go to and giving it all and letting them know that, you know, what you guys have done for me has helped me get to this point.
Nick says he's not just thinking about himself anymore. He's trying to build up a community of guides in St. Louis so more people with disabilities can run. And he's reached out to race directors around the city, asking them to add divisions for athletes with disabilities.
And every race I run, there's somebody running, there's somebody comes to me and says, hey, I saw you guys out there killing it. You guys are doing so good. And the goal is to bring people with disabilities into limelight and say, you can do this. Just gotta try.
That story came to us from reporter Shayla Farzan in St. Louis. What happens when you cross Game of Thrones with the NBA? You get Game of Zones.
Oh, is that what they said at House Thunder when they traded away James Harden?
Ah, man, that's not the same. Silver Lord, bless this trade, for it is fair and for the good of the realm.
How could you do this to your most loyal knight?
Not just him.
The story behind the hit video series, that's just ahead on Only a Game. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
My darkest past can be a beacon of light for somebody else. I can say, hey, look what I've walked through. You can walk through this too.
Kind World, stories about how profound acts of kindness, big and small, can change lives.
Honestly, the most transformative thing was being treated like a person when I didn't even feel like I was a human.
Our new season starts April 16th with new episodes every Tuesday. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jay Adande. Next week on Only a Game, the debate over lacrosse helmets for girls enters a new chapter. But now, Charlie Pierce is here with this week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, J.A.
It was Kentucky Derby weekend approached. I found it hard to get excited about a horse race after more than 20 horses had to be put down at Santa Anita in California this season. What's your level of enthusiasm for an event that feels increasingly from another era?
I'm one of the few people of my generation that still goes for the romance and the history, but the industry was in a lot of trouble anyway. With casino gambling and everything else, its economics weren't feasible before all this happened, and now the sport could be in terminal shape.
I've always found it interesting that the same people that you see posting on social media about rescue dogs and, you know, all these animal rights activists, they're the same ones that come Derby week, they're putting on their hats and saying, I'm so excited for the Kentucky Derby, when this sport does put these beautiful animals at risk.
You know, it was the Louisville Courier-Journal in an admirable piece of local reporting said that Churchill Downs is one of the deadliest racetracks in America and that lost 43 horses since 2016. That's almost three per 1,000 starts, and that's 50% higher than the national average. People may not understand the relationship between casino gambling and racetrack gambling, but people understand beautiful dead animals.
Exactly. That is dire.
And if the beautiful dead animals start piling up, you've got an image problem you can't overcome.
Well, Charlie, the signed score sheet from the March 2nd, 1962 NBA game in which Will Chamberlain dropped 100 points, well, that sold last weekend for $214,000. Well, actually, for $214,579. How do you explain that? $579?
The $9 is what won it for the guy. The guy probably bid $9 more than the other guy. I did not know that the score sheet existed, and if you had told me it existed, I would have said for sure it was in the Basketball Hall of Fame. But it was, you know, it was up for private auction, and the guy who bought it is anonymous, and we'll find out it's Charlie Sheen at some point. I'm fairly sure of that. I really wish it was up there in Springfield where we could all go and look at it.
That actually seems a little low to me. I mean, that is the Mount Olympus, you could say, of basketball, the 100-point game. No one's even really come close to it, if you think about it. I mean, 214, I think somebody got off a little light. At least bid him up to 214, 580 or something.
Well, I'm not a high roller like you are. Maybe it's because it's one step removed from Wilt himself. I mean, if it was the ball or his shoes or his uniform or something, you would get a gigantic price. But this is basically, you know, some guy who worked in Hershey, Pennsylvania, who got picked to keep score that night.
His notes.
Yeah, exactly. What's the most famous sports event you ever covered?
Wow.
I've been to some of them.
Just pick one. Pick one.
The game six when Ray Allen hit the shot against the Spurs.
Sell your notebook immediately. Put your notebook up for auction right now. You'd settle for $200,000. I would, certainly. For my notebook from the sixth game of the World Series in 1986.
Well, on Tuesday night, Yankees pitcher CC Sabathia became just the third lefty with 3,000 career strikeouts. Will he reach 4,000? If so, when?
I don't know. 25 years from now, the guy's a freak of nature. I mean, he looks like the center fielder on your beer league softball team. But now he's got 3,000 strikeouts. That puts him in the Hall of Fame, as far as I'm concerned.
Really? That's
threshold. Oh, 3,000 strikeouts? Absolutely.
My thing is, will we still value this number when people strike out all the time now and pitchers are racking up strikeouts left and right? Like, a 10-strikeout game isn't even that big a deal these days.
Well, maybe not, but 3,000 strikeouts is still, you know, I mean, if you look at the people immediately above CC Sabathia, Smoltz is in the Hall of Fame. Schilling isn't yet, but he probably should be. Then the next three are Gibson, Pedro Martinez, and Fergie Jenkins. So wow. The guy is in company, let's put it that way.
The NFL held its 2019 draft last week in Nashville. It drew a record 600,000 people. So I guess it's safe to say that the decision to take the draft out of New York and turn it into sort of a traveling roadshow was a good idea, huh?
Yeah. Oh, we love these. America loves these spectacles now where you have the giant crowds outside and the people inside, and even something as endlessly tedious as the NFL draft can draw that many people. Now, I wouldn't try it again. I'd find another city next year. You know, Las Vegas, maybe. Who knows?
I mean, can you imagine being the guy at the back of that 600,000-person crowd? Like, can you even see the stage? And even if you could, what are you watching? You're watching a big guy in an ill-fitting suit walk across the stage and put on a hat.
Well, you know, there were people who sat a mile and a half away at Woodstock and claimed to be sitting in Jimi Hendrix's lap now. So, you know, the story will get better as the years go by.
And finally, Charlie, we're halfway through the final season of Game of Thrones, and the sports world is getting in on the fun. Would you like to introduce us to the delicacy that the Hartford Yard Goats fans will be enjoying on May 11th?
Another great minor league baseball team of whom I need a T-shirt desperately. They're calling it the Seven Kingdoms Burger, which has all kinds of ketchup, which makes it look bloody, and something called Dragon Bacon, and the Sriracha ketchup, which means that your mouth will be on fire when it's done, and it looks completely unhealthy, and I'm dying to try one.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week here at Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, J.A.
On a Wednesday morning last July, reports came out that the Toronto Raptors were trading their all-star guard, DeMar DeRozan. DeRozan had spent his entire career, 9 years, with the Raptors. He posted to his Instagram story, "Ain't no loyalty in this game." The news was also a blow to Kyle Lowry, DeRozan's co-star and close friend on the Raptors. Lowry was later asked about the trade by ESPN's Rachel Nichols.
I mean, DeMar was very open this summer about feeling betrayed. Yeah. Did you feel betrayed?
I felt betrayed because he felt betrayed because that's my guy. That's my best friend. So, yeah.
It sounds almost as dramatic as an episode of Game of Thrones, right?
You knew it was poisoned.
I suspected.
You betrayed me.
Martin Kessler of House Only a Game, First of His Name, Weaver of Tales, and Regent of Radio, has this story.
Kyle, wake up. Kyle, Kyle.
Norman, what are you doing?
It's a trade. We're making a trade.
A trade? Why didn't anyone tell me?
Well, you know, you did.
That's a scene from a recent episode of Game of Zones. It's an animated video series that imagines what would happen if real-life NBA drama unfolded in a medieval Game of Thrones-inspired universe.
Silver Lord, bless this trade, for it is fair and for the good of the realm.
How could you do this to your most loyal knight?
It's definitely a little weird.
Please, I'll do whatever you ask, I'll shoot more threes.
But Game of Zones has been a hit since 2014. The show's short episodes about off-court NBA drama, like LeBron joining the Lakers or Jimmy Butler reportedly telling his teammates, "You bleeping need me," get millions of views. NBA players and coaches are among its fans. And it all started with a pair of brothers, one who worked in reality TV and another who spent more time studying astrophysics than he studied basketball.
My name's Adam Malamut.
And I'm Craig Malamut, Adam's brother.
Well, tell me where you guys grew up, and was it very medieval?
Yeah, we are subsistence farmers that from England.
We are from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, which is outside of Philadelphia, where the closest thing to a medieval accent is the local people who say things like, "Hey, you's all going to go down there to watch the Eagles game, you the Wawa's over there." That's how people talk. So it's sort of medieval. And if you go to an Eagles game, that is fairly medieval.
Some behaviors that yeah. reminiscent of.
Yeah. I would say, actually, though, growing up, the biggest influence, weirdly, of all the medieval stuff was Robin Hood Men in Tights.
And I say we fight back! Yeah. Are you with me? Yay or nay?
Which one means yes?
Yay. Yay!
We would, like, memorize every line from that movie, and it, like, literally, I think, shaped my sense of humor and personality.
Adam is 6.5 years older than Craig. They have a sister, Kate, who's in the middle. Adam was always interested in drawing.
I used to love to draw and create characters.
We'd go on, like, road trips, and Adam would be in the back seat of, like, a minivan, and he would put socks on his hand and do a sock puppet show for me and my sister.
And eventually I noticed that, this little Craig guy is also a good artist. but I need to show him how dominant I am at drawing, being 6.5 years older. So we started playing this game called the drawing game, we'd call it. And the game was we'd have two pieces of paper and...
Or three. Kate would play sometimes, but she'd get bored.
We'd make up a superhero and we'd both draw it. So like, we would say something like, okay, Pineapple Rhino Man.
And then when it's all done, I would show Adam mine, and it would suck, and then Adam would show me his, and I'd be like, oh my god, that's awesome! And then I'd copy what he did.
When Craig was in sixth grade, Adam went off to Emerson College in Boston to study writing, directing, and acting.
When Adam left, it was a huge bummer, because he was, like, so entertaining. It was like having a, like... Adam's loving this. He's nodding along. But it's like having a comedian in the house that made custom jokes about, like, your whole family dynamics.
When it was Craig's time to go off to college, he didn't follow in his brother's footsteps. He set off on a quest of his own. He studied astrophysics.
I got involved in a research project about the interstellar medium, which is it's like the least sexy part of astrophysics, but it's the gas and dust between stars.
But Adam would soon derail his brother's academic career, because while Craig was studying space dust, Adam was trying to make it in LA. After graduating from Emerson, Adam started working in reality TV. After a while, he landed with Jimmy Kimmel Live.
I thought it was like a dream job to get on a comedy show like that, and I was a TV watcher, which meant that my job was to watch TV and find funny clips. But I found that it was a long process to move into the writer's room from there.
Adam says he was also working long hours and not making much money.
There was something like nagging me to finally put it together and go my own path and teach myself animation.
Adam started an online tutorial.
I just taught myself how to animate and I started making stuff.
3 or 4 years later, he made a video featuring animated versions of Philadelphia Phillies players Chase Utley and Ryan Howard talking on the team bus. Adam did the voices.
I think about hitting home runs all the time.
Me too. Like,
it's like my favorite thing
to do. It's my favorite thing to do.
Just the feel of the ball on the bat. And,
all they do is sit and talk because I couldn't really move characters at the time.
I love hitting home runs.
That's, I love that.
I just... Oh, God, how good are home runs?
It's so, like, good.
A friend of mine saw that cartoon who worked for Yahoo, and he said, hey, let's make this into a series.
Adam agreed to do 6 episodes. He soon realized he needed help.
So he said, like, Craig, can you, like, you know how to draw. Like, do the background artwork.
At the time, Craig was working on his master's degree in astrophysics, but he obeyed his elder brother. He started making backgrounds for the series, which was called Sports Friends. Then 2 things happened. Craig finished his master's, and Yahoo picked up a second season.
And Adam is there going like, come on to LA, we're going to be cartoon brothers in Hollywood. And I was like, oh man, I can't resist this. So I was like, whatever, I'm young, I'll take a chance.
The brothers started working out of Adam's apartment. They were overwhelmed.
We were up in, like, pulling all-nighters to get this stuff done. It was actually a pretty challenging time for Craig and I as brothers, because we had always had this relationship where I was just the older brother, always entertaining, but now we were in it together, and Craig was sort of paying the price a little bit for me not knowing what I was doing.
But on Sunday nights, the brothers could count on one distraction.
Game of Thrones for us, that was something we really enjoyed doing together. It was like a precious hour that we'd come together, and like it was like sort of like our new Robin Hood Mennonites, except much more serious with way more beheadings and deaths.
It would also help change their fate. After they finished the second season of Sports Friends, Craig and Adam learned Yahoo wasn't picking up the show again. They started scrambling to find work.
I was actually looking at jobs at the Griffith Observatory to supplement my money.
Yeah.
I was like, I have this degree. I got to use it.
And it could be pretty scary and frustrating at times, because we were always like best friends and brothers. And now this pressure of having to make a living here and having to work together as a team professionally was putting that at risk.
And here's where Game of Thrones comes back into the story. When Craig and Adam were still making Sports Friends, they talked about doing an episode that compared Patriots quarterback Tom Brady to a character from Game of Thrones. And the idea of a mashup was still in the back of their heads when they met with Bennett Spector from the website Bleacher Report to talk about making some videos.
And then, like, offhand, I brought up this idea we'd been kicking around with Tom Brady. And he's like, ooh, I like that. He's like, but, you know, NBA season's coming up. It's like that moment of, like, when Justin Timberlake and The Social Network is like, make it just Facebook.
Drop the just Facebook.
He was like, could you make about the NBA? And we're like, yeah, sure, whatever.
So the brothers agreed to make a single video mashing up the NBA and Game of Thrones. But Craig quickly realized there was a problem.
I don't even think I knew who Steph Curry was at the time, to be completely honest.
Luckily, Adam was a big sports fan, and the brothers began combining NBA players and Game of Thrones characters. The dominant Spurs, often maligned for playing a boring style of basketball, were compared to undead villains known as the White Walkers. LeBron James, who at the time was winning championships with the Miami Heat, became Jaime Lannister, a knight from a powerful house.
You know, when we made it, we were just like, okay, you know, this is in the Venn diagram of like NBA fans and Game of Thrones fans, there's probably not a ton of overlap. We're like, what are we doing? Let's probably get like 20,000 views at most.
On May 16th, 2014, the video went live.
You're the best player in Boros, and you're afraid of some scrubs from Washingfell.
Dynasties fall, Lord Ridley.
It went crazy. We had no idea, but it went so viral. And Bennett said, like, we want to do another one of those. And, you know, at the time, we're like, oh, God. You know, we're like, this is really not meant to be more than one.
But they managed to put together a second video. It also blew up. Bleacher Report asked the brothers to come on board full time. In the year since the show debuted, Game of Zones has expanded beyond Game of Thrones. The brothers say the show is now set in its own medieval basketball universe. And Adam and Craig now have a staff of more than 20 people. They still direct, write, and voice the characters. Adam says he and Craig have learned to complement each other well. After all those years of proving his dominance in the drawing game, Adam has allowed his younger brother to become the de facto team executive. They say their mom keeps close tabs on the show. Whenever a new episode comes out,
she's at her, what she calls her battle station, and she's like searching Twitter, and
she even once had a burner account where she would comment positively on our videos, but we put that to bed. We ended that very quickly.
Yeah, that was, we're like, please do not get down this road.
Adam and Craig Malema don't need the help. That recent episode about the DeMar DeRozan trade already has about 2 million views on YouTube.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Adam and Craig Malamud are now also executive producers for another animated show from Bleacher Report called The Champions. Think pro soccer drama crossed with a reality TV show. You can find episodes of both series on YouTube or on the Bleacher Report app. We'll have links at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is Karen Given. I'm J.A. Adande. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.